The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
It's excellent to be here. I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his personal chef, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 60 of The Big Picture for the week beginning May 22nd. Coming up on today's show for our diamond anniversary, yes, we're 60, we bring you Jack of the Red Hearts, a tale about the highs and lows of autistic childhood.
Then we check out the latest report from war-torn Afghanistan with comedy drama Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
And the end of the world we've all been waiting for, X-Men Apocalypse, this week with real Gen Y fans.
Real Gen Y fans.
Humanely caught and released for your entertainment.
Mark, always a pleasure, never a chore to see you. How are things?
Things in general are fairly normal.
Great. And right, thanks for that rapid summation of your life. So moving on then with the show, shall we? I thought you would have put a bit more oomph into that one. Really?
I feel like my life is a series of average achievements.
Increasingly getting averager. Well, that was Mark this week. Also around this week, Mark, at cinemas is The Meddler. I reviewed this movie on the show last week. If you missed it, go to thebigpicturewebsite.com or go to hope1032.com.au and check out my 60-second verdict. It's got Susan Sarandon, Rose Byrne, and I don't think the title does a good service to the movie overall, Mark. It's not so much a meddling mum as a mum trying to look for meaning later in life.
We'll be adding that to our view list. And kicking off this week on the PlayStation Network. Yes, we're now reviewing all sorts of streaming networks on The Big Picture.
There's a PlayStation Network?
Well, okay, for those of you under 25, the PlayStation Network.
Okay, over 25.
Anyway, Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce, a comedy drama that follows the ups and down life of Abby McCarthy, played by Lisa Edelston, a best-selling author of a self-help book series who's secretly hiding her separation from her husband. Basically, this is just more of a laugh at self-help than anything else. Each episode kind of patterns off a rule like never lie to your kids episode or always take advantage of me time, which ultimately proves to be fruitless. So, you know, I haven't seen an episode yet, but I'm kind of interested in something that would actually point a laughing finger at this sort of crazy industry.
Something that caught my attention, Mark, that's out on Blu-ray and DVD this week is a movie called Regression. Have you heard of a movie called Regression? It's out this week.
It sounds pretty good. Is it science fiction?
No, it's not.
Then it
not.
Doesn't sound good at all.
But it's gone straight to Blu-ray and DVD, even though it has Emma Watson, as in Hermione from Harry Potter fame. Now,
That's because they want to get it straight to the people. It's bad.
I would have thought after Harry Potter, pretty much all the biggest stars in that series would have been able to get their movies into cinemas. So I was a little bit surprised to see Regression hasn't done that. Emma Watson is playing a young woman who accuses her father of something, an unspeakable crime that happened to her in the past, and Ethan Hawke is the detective who's brought in to solve that case, Mark. Regression, out now for fans of Hermione, I presume.
And Ethan Hawke. Three of them. Okay. Look, actually, here's something really good. Wayward Pines Season 2 is starting up on Foxtel this Saturday.
Have you watched it? Did you watch the first season?
Yeah, it was pretty compelling, hey?
It was? I didn't actually see it. That's why I'm asking you. The one with Matt Dillon.
The first season is Matt Dillon, as you say. He plays a Secret Service agent called Ethan Burke, who is in a car crash with a couple of other agents. And they wake up in a town, or at least a couple of them are dead. So he wakes up. Anyway, in a town which he cannot escape from. And it's run by a bizarre sheriff who is sort of enforcing these rules that keeps everybody dancing between life and death. But there's something quite mystical about the boundaries of the town. Well, anyway, season two, this is what I'm moving to. Season two is coming out this Saturday, and it's the executive producer is M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong.
Oh, your mate, your old mate. The guy please pronounce that again for us.
Shyamalan.
Yeah, Shyamalan, the guy who made The Sixth Sense.
The guy who really should have thought about his last name. Okay, The Sixth Sense, The Visit, that's right. And it's an American mystery science fiction series based on the Wayward Pines novels by Blake Crouch. It stars Matt Dillon, Juliet Lewis. Season one is off. Season two is on. Well worth having a look at.
In entertainment news this week, Mark, you would have heard the little thing called the Cannes Film Festival was happening throughout the week.
That old get-together.
That old thing. Rather than some of the movies that were around there, something that caught my eye was the Cannes Celebrity Gift Lounge that was happening earlier in the week at Cannes, where a company called GBK Productions, who put together this lounge, had these big free bags, gift bags, to give away to the celebrities that were there. And what was given away in the bag totaled about $69,000. Of stuff, including an $8,000 three-night stay at a Caribbean resort, a $2,500 watch, a $10,000 artwork that streams audio through it, somehow.
And it's kind of like the Mona Lisa singing to
it. It is. And $40,000 in savings because you can have free installation of solar panels at your celebrity house. If you've been at Cannes earlier in the week and you were famous.
I thought a celebrity gift lounge was when you actually went into the lounge and they gave you a celebrity.
Oh, and which would be great depending on who the celebrity was. That was happening at Cannes this week.
Okay. Well, listen, do you remember the Carry On films?
I do, yes, because I am over 25.
31 low-budget British comedy productions made between 1958 and 1992, 4 Christmas specials, a television series of 13 episodes, and 3 West End productions. How do you even turn the Carry Ons into a West End production? Anyway, well, they're back. The film's humour was the basic comedy tradition of the British music hall.
This isn't a joke?
No, this is not a joke. It's been brought into the 21st century with a slate of new old comedies. It's been revealed that the first Carry On film in 24 years is going into production. It's titled Carry On Doctors. No real surprise there. It's obviously going to be one of those. Anyway, it's written by Tim Dawson and Susan Nixon, who wrote the epic... Susan Nixon wrote the epic and thought-provoking television series Two Pints of Lager and a Packet of Chips. Crisps. Sorry, it was a British show. I think this is kind of really interesting that it's actually going to just be done again. It was a train wreck when it was the original thing, so now they're going to do it again. They've even named the second one, Carry On Campus.
Okay. Let's move on to the rest of the show because that's just depressing. Before we get to our first now showing choice, Mark, I have a true or false statement to put to all of us.
True or false me.
We are going to be talking about X-Men Apocalypse later in the show. So I thought, here's an X-Men true or false. Tell me whether this is true or false, what I'm about to say.
I'm ready.
Hugh Jackman yells and punches for half an hour every morning when he's preparing to perform as Wolverine, and he's done that ever since the first X-Men film. Is that true or false? He yells and punches for half an hour every morning when preparing to be Wolverine.
Can you imagine just being a co-star and asking for your dressing room to be moved? Hugh Jackman, he's so flipping loud.
I know that guy. Every morning. Is that true or false? I will reveal whether it is or not after we speak about what we're about to talk about now.
Well, we're moving on to our first now showing segment. With X-Men dominating filmgoers' attention, it would be easy to think that there was nothing else coming out. But one of the smaller yet noteworthy releases this week is our first now showing choice for the show. Jack of the Red Heart stars the Soul Surfer herself, Anna Sophia Robb, as a juvenile delinquent who lies her way into this tough job of taking care of an 11-year-old autistic girl. It's at select cinemas around Australia. This heartfelt drama made Ben cry.
True story.
As it causes viewers to consider what a loving family can actually look like.
Glory, come on. Not noodle time. Get up.
We went over this. Undershirt, then pants, then shirt. Don't ask me why the order matters, but it does.
I got a job. I'm getting us a place.
Come on, let's go.
I don't want to feel like we're co-workers in a mental hospital.
She's autistic, so she needs someone with her, like, all the time.
How did you even get this job?
You don't just tell little fibs. Your lies are extraordinary.
Bethany, I have a couple people I'd like you to meet.
Would she have friends? Would she call me mommy?
Okay, so let's begin with what's with the title?
I know, right?
Jack of the Red Hearts.
It's a terribly uninspiring title. It's like annoyingly cryptic, not very catchy. I can't see yourself running down the street saying, hey, you should go see Jack of the Red Hearts. But I'm about to actually say that. You should go see Jack of the Red Hearts.
I just want to point out that Consuela, our producer, did point out that all hearts in a pack of cards are red. So why?
Yeah, there's thank you, Consuela, because there is all of that going on with the title. Let's just face it, the title's not very good, and it's not really even referenced on screen, which is I won't kind of go into it, but it's almost so like such a tangent, it doesn't really matter. The lead character in the film is Jack, played by Anna Sophia Robb, Jacqueline. She's a juvenile delinquent who is trying to get custody of her sister because they've both been in foster homes since they were kids. She's now 18. She's trying to get a job, sort out her life so she can live with her sister. She lies her way into this carer role, if you can believe it. It's actually fairly credible on screen how she manages to do it. She's just basically a really good liar. Lies her way into this job of caring for this young girl, Glory, played by an excellent little actress called Taylor Richardson. That's a fantastic job as an autistic 11-year-old girl. But what Jack finds herself in is a situation he didn't expect, which is I'm now a carer of not just a girl, but a girl with significant needs and demands every single day. So while the title of the film, Jack of the Red Hearts, got something to do with Jack and something to do with Red Hearts, just kind of ignore that and instead go along and see this little movie, which was really quite, I found, surprisingly powerful, provocative, believable presentation of a family going through a very difficult situation.
Wow. I mean, so what affected you the most about it? Because obviously you've been moved by it.
Yeah, but I teared up at a couple of times. I was really surprised. There are other movies I think that would do that to me and they don't. And I find it quite difficult sometimes to see people on screen who have particular issues that they're struggling against that for one reason or another hold them back from the kind of quote-unquote normal lives that a lot of people lead. And Glory, this 11-year-old girl, definitely has that going on. So for me, the most moving part was Glory and watching her day-to-day activities. And it's Taylor Richardson does a fantastic job of channeling autism. She doesn't seem to be patronizing or just turning it on or making a show of it. Janet Grillo, the lady who's directed this, has done a great job of harnessing this little talent. So seeing Glory just have small wins, like learning how to eat better or to communicate better or to handle her emotions, is really quite potent. So it made me tear up, and a lot of it though really did have to do with getting to see what happens inside a family that is experiencing this. And then Jack, Anna Sophia Robb's character, is effectively our eyes as the audience going into this situation. And you get, if you've never experienced anything like this, I think Jack of the Red Heart seems to me to be quite a strong representation of what it's like dealing with autism as a family.
What about the value with human life? I mean, this is the interesting thing about films that involve disability. We always seem to come out with a better idea of the value of human life. Does Jack of the Red Hearts contribute anything to that?
Yeah. Those behind this film have had some personal experience with autism. Janet Grillo, the director, has an autistic child. And that seems to flow through the film in terms of there's a realism. There's moments where it's like a telemovie. There's often too many moments in this film, I thought, where Jack, the carer, got away with things. She doesn't know what she's doing. And think she just gets away with it, even though she's really messing it up. I thought that got sort of papered over a little bit. However, what comes through, I think, very strongly in this film is the value of each human life. And that's a very simple point, that every human life, no matter what you can do, what your abilities are, what you cannot do, doesn't change the fact that you're a human life. It reminded me constantly through the film of that every single person is created in the image of God, and you can't take that away from someone. So whether someone can function well or not doesn't change the fact that they are still a person in the image of God, and all of us are on exactly the same level. And as such, there is a real dignity to that, I think. And it helped me to think more about how am I treating other people? Am I judging other people? All these kind of things. Am I even suggesting that some people aren't in the image of God like I think I should be, et cetera, et cetera. It got me thinking about all those things. Dignity is massive in this film, comes through very strongly. I was very affected by Jack of the Red Hearts.
Wow, that's on our list for sure. Okay, well, Anna Sophia Robb, Famke Janssen, I believe that's how you pronounce it.
Oh, I like that. She plays the mum in the movie. She's in X-Men, which we're talking about later in the show.
Yes, but as Famke Janssen?
As Famke Janssen.
Okay, and Taylor Richardson star in Jack of the Red Hearts. Put it on Google because this fine drama is only showing at select cinemas. It's rated PG for mild themes and coarse language.
Before we talked about Jack of the Red Hearts, I posed this true or false statement. Tell me if it's true or false. Hugh Jackman yells and punches for half an hour every morning when he's preparing to perform as Wolverine. True or false?
I'm going to go with true because he's nine kinds of crazy.
I'm going to tell you that's false.
Whoa.
What Hugh Jackman actually does is take ice cold showers every morning of filming in order to get into character. So he doesn't just yell and punch. Well, he probably does that in the shower, actually. So maybe it's a mix. However, what I do know for truth is that he definitely takes ice cold showers. He's done that since day one as Wolverine. He continues to do it because it fires him up be that guy.
Anyone who does that with a cold shower, you're going to be yelling and screaming in the shower. Maybe it's something his acting coach does for him, sort of sneaks into the bar. Bathroom and on with a cold tap, ready to play. Okay, well, coming up on the show yet, we still have some fantastic stuff to talk about. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, having a look at Afghanistan, plus also moving through to this is what I'm kind of interested in, what the Bible has to say about wasting time and our favourite top five wasting time films.
Welcome back.
I feel so welcome.
To this Big Picture show.
Up in just a few moments is our second now showing choice for the week, the true story turned comedy drama, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. But before we get there, we thought for this week's soundtrack segment, we delve into its musical side. Ready for a blast from the past? Get ready for some high step bopping and White Man's Overbite. Here's A-ha's 80s classic, Take On Me. We'll be right back. As I said in the intro to this song, it features in film Whiskey Tango Foxtrot pretty prominently, actually, as a sort of a success soundtrack for the key character's triumph in delivering some pretty explosive news while embedded with a US Marine unit. It's actually not the first time it's featured in a soundtrack, though. Take On Me got a run in 2012's This Is 40, as well as outings in The Family Guy and South Park, but my favourite would have to be its thoughtful and endearing inclusion in the soundtrack to the video game Metal Gear Solid 5, the Phantom Pain.
That's your choice?
Well, it says it all, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. Creative writers have commented on the fog of war, that murky mixture of misinformation and stupidity that makes it almost impossible to know what's actually going on during a conflict. That fog's been going on since a guy, little old guy called Leo Tolstoy, wrote a tiny work you might have heard of. It's called War and Peace. This week in our second Now Showing segment, we take a look at a new release that's based on US TV reporter Kim Barker's memoir about the time she spent covering the war in Afghanistan in the early 2000s. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot stars Tina Fey and is a sometimes funny, sometimes serious look at the pressure-driven world of the war correspondent and the need to have a spiritual anchor more secure than a bottle of spirits.
Miss Baker, this is an extreme environment.
Grenade, down, down!
I've seen people with actual experience make bad decisions here.
You should let me interview you.
But I do not know you. How can we get to know each other?
Yes, kid, excellent.
It's bananas here. I don't think I can do this.
We are all here for a reason.
So what's your reason?
I just wanted out of my job. I wanted out of my mildly depressive boyfriend.
What are we doing, Kim?
Just wanted to blow everything up.
That's the most American white lady story I've ever heard.
Tina Fey stars as Kim Barker, a journalist in a no-thrills network job. Basically, she's writing copy for uninterested, you know, events. And she realizes her life is going nowhere, so what do? You volunteer to report in Afghanistan.
That's what everyone would decide to do. Yep. What choice do you have, really?
Mine was to do a radio show. But you know, that's when you think nothing else is happening.
Not this one. This is top of your list.
Yes, this is the second one. In the capital of Afghanistan, Kabul, actually, as it's basically pronounced, she uncovers a disreputable society of journalists and cameramen who are all waiting for the next big story to break, and some of them are keen enough to push things along a bit and get that story happening. Well, it's a world of extreme cynicism, unbridled relationships, a moral vacuum filled by the tedium of waiting and the envy of others' exclusives, strange relationships, and the unendurable military nonsense that passes for public relations. You know, the city itself is no better. Its populace is being crushed by a cruel Islamic regime, political corruption, and the weight of a never-ending war. Kim begins to get lost in this maze of frustration and futility. She's not really sure why she's there until finally the man she's falling for gets kidnapped, and that seems to give her some sort of role now for her journalistic skills. But the truth is, if she finds the man she's looking for, will she really find the meaning she was looking for in Afghanistan? And to be honest, that's up for grabs.
Mark, this isn't the first time Hollywood's had a go at carrying off a war memoir. So which path, among all those different paths you just mentioned there, which one does Whiskey Tango Foxtrot as a movie go down?
I'm not really sure. I mean, to be
okay.
Honest,
because You've seen the movie, I take it.
I've seen the movie. And, you know, if you looked at the trailer, you'd say, okay, it's going for a comedy, right?
And just having Tina Fey in it, you would expect that's
Tina
the case.
Exactly. Tina Fey's, look, for those people who don't know Tina Fey's comedy chops are huge. Saturday Night Live, 30 Rock.
30 Rock!
You know, Date Night, Megamind, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which she produced. Wrote and produced. But she just doesn't seem to have enough to work with in this. It's just not comic material.
What about all the others that she's surrounded by? It's a great cast. Billy Bob Thornton's in here, and Martin Freeman doing something of a Fargo TV series reunion, kind of. Margot Robbie, the Australian actress.
You'd seriously think that there was enough material in there and enough acting talent to turn this into real comedy. But look, Men Who Stare at Goats is a better version of what this could have been. If you haven't seen that, go see that. It's fantastic.
That was weird, kind of funny. Did you think it got there in the end? George Clooney, that film?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I personally had it. I thought it's one of those films where you can actually take that whole craziness of war and get a bit of a laugh out of it. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot seems to suggest that this should be, you know, a funny take on what's going on in war, but it's not.
So it's not so much a black comedy. Does that mean it's more dramatic?
Yeah, I would have thought that would have been the other option.
What other options do we have? Look, a musical. It could have been a musical.
It could have been a children's story. Look, it aims for drama. It concerns itself mainly with Kim's attempts to build a career for herself. Okay, so this is the idea that she's going to do that. But drama-wise, it kind of falls short too. It's nowhere near the sort of the real journalistic triumphs and thrills of the Year of Living Dangerously. And it's not even close to the creepier side of journalism where people sort of trade off like the Nightcrawler. It doesn't even have enough of those crazy sort of, I can't believe they did that moments, you know, to get away with the story. It just doesn't seem to
Did you
rise.
Find it odd that it's set in a war zone and a particularly a contemporary one, so effectively one that feels like ripped from our headlines right now, and yet it seems to be focusing on this one American lady's journey of some sorts in this place? As in, do you get any sense of the conflict that she's in and around and reporting on? Do you learn anything about Afghanistan during this time?
The closest you come to learning about Afghanistan, and I think this is part of one of the purposes of the film, is a sense of how difficult it is for women, okay, in that environment, and how suppressed relationships can become in a fundamentalist Islamic regime. But I don't think you really walk away with much. It could have just as easily been Iraq. It could have been a destabilized African republic. It could have been the Balkans, you know, during a crisis 20 years ago. It's just not really specific to the
location. So if you think that, it sounds like you're still confused by this, but possibly the purpose of this film is more about Kim's journey than a journalistic investigation.
Yeah, it's so, all about how far she goes.
So what is she learning?
Well, strangely, I guess our guest last week, we had journalist Evan Batten on, could have given her the lesson in a sentence that you can't actually go into an environment like this without some sort of moral anchor that you leave behind to keep you close, you know, to what you actually believe. They refer in the film to the whole idea of living in Kabul as like the kabobble. Okay, the whole idea of we're in a bubble and strange things happen. It's true. There's excessive alcohol and strange social rules and sleeping around and crazy use of drugs and stuff like that. It's as if people are living in an environment where you've got no rules, no restrictions.
No consequences, seemingly.
Yeah, and you'll come out of it and you'll go back to your own world. But Kim eventually comes to the conclusion that she has to get out of the bubble because it will change her. But I'm not really sure what she went in. She didn't carry much away as a lesson, and she didn't really learn much while she was there. And this is, for me, the real tragedy of the film. Because you see, look, the real tragedies in life, war is one of the greater ones, but I think even greater than that is not learning from the circumstances that God puts you in. Okay, you can actually, we've talked so far about Jack of the Red Hearts, and in fact, what someone learns from being in a family with an autistic child. Look, learning about being in a war, when coming out of a war zone or visiting a country where in which the lifestyle is so dramatically different, what do you learn by it? What is the situation that God has put you in, and are you learning from it? And that's the big question for me. C.S. Lewis says we get put into a deliberately moral universe so we can make moral choices, and if we choose the good, it'll lead us closer to God. Look, in this case, Kim basically makes no real choices except to leave and learns nothing from the process. And that's the real tragedy of Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot is rated MA15+ for strong coarse language and brief injury detail. Brief injury detail. That's like an official classification category.
Look, that guy got a cut in his arm. Don't look closely.
Briefly.
There you go.
It stars Tina Fey, Martin Freeman, our own Margot Robbie and Billy Bob Thornton. And is now showing, which means you can now go and see it unless there's something else on TV that you'd rather watch instead. I also want to point you to another take on Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. Russ Matthews' review over at Insights, insights.uca.org.au. And also to let you know, apart from checking out Whiskey Tango Foxtrot as reviewed by Russ and see what he thought of it, let everybody know Russ is going to be on the show in a couple of weeks' time. Mark's going to be taking, what are you doing, Mark? A sabbatical.
I'm taking a holiday.
I'm
actually editing my second novel, which will be coming out soon.
Sure, you're taking a holiday.
I'm taking a holiday.
And Russ will be joining us on a few episodes of forthcoming Big Pictures.
Okay, listen, if you'd like to see all sorts of other things on the interwebs, head over to thebigpicturewebsite.com. Thebigpicturewebsite.com is where we store all of the sort of things that we said last week and the week before and the week before that. In fact, for the previous 59 shows and all the sorts of other associated articles and videos that we do with, that are part of the extravaganza that is The Big Picture, all over at thebigpicturewebsite.com.
Still to come on this extravaganza episode of The Big Picture, X-Men Apocalypse. And Mark also speaks with real-life Gen Ys.
It was scary. Welcome back.
Here we are again then, Mark, still in The Big Picture. And at this point in the show, well, actually not right at this point, coming up very soon, we're going to take a look at our much-anticipated What Your Kids Are Watching film for this week, X-Men Apocalypse. X-Men Apocalypse.
Couldn't get more dramatic.
You couldn't. But before we do, let's meet some of the kids, quote-unquote, who are lining up to watch it. Well, you know, 20-somethings, but they're still the kids. There was a time when comic book hero films would have been considered the exclusive property only of guys, and mainly those guys with an unhealthy knowledge of the backstories of the Justice League. But Mark took up the matter with one Gen Y couple and found out that films like X-Men Apocalypse are capable of becoming today's date movie.
Terrence Sim, thanks very much for being part of The Big Picture and particularly for talking to us about this idea of dating and comic book films. There was a time when superhero movies were kind of the territory of guys who collected comic books, who had propeller hats. Is that the sort of state of comic book films amongst your friends now?
I think personally, growing up, comic books were definitely a male-dominated kind of scene. But I think actually it was through high school where I started to notice more and more females getting, I guess, yeah, really into the scene of comic books. And especially now that at church where, you know, we're surrounded by uni students and young workers, there are actually a fair few females. And I might even say some of the females are more hardcore fans than the males themselves.
Can I backtrack just a little bit there and just ask quickly for a clarification? Did you notice the girls first in high school or the comic books?
Depends on my mood, I guess, you know.
Sim, did you have any experience with comic books in high school?
No, I definitely didn't have any experience with comic books in high school. It was mainly when the movies started coming out, like X-Men and things like that, that I actually started to be exposed to those kind of stories.
Terrence, I take it you're the reader in terms of comic books. How do you find this sort of almost complete transition of the medium onto the big screen? Do you think it's fairly faithful?
Fairly. There are disappointments, no doubt. I think, you know, being a bit of a elitist at heart, you know, I love to see the stories from the comics brought to life. But yeah, at the end of the day, I think the standard of superhero movies is definitely going up. And what we read on the comics is definitely being true to what we see in the films as well.
Sim, with the storylines that are out there are so many different types of storylines. You've got, you know, your Superman storyline, your Batman storyline, your Iron Man storyline. Do you have any particular favourites? And please don't say Thor and Chris Hemsworth.
I'd say either definitely Batman would be my favourite. If you include X-Men, then X-Men would be up there as well.
Now, why would you say X-Men?
I think I like the more fantasy aspect of it, the fact that their powers are not man-made and that you don't know what you're expecting because everyone's going to be very different and you don't know who's going to win in a battle because you don't know the extent of their powers as well.
Regards the X-Men Apocalypse film, having chatted to you guys earlier, I know that you sectioned that one out as a date. Does that actually qualify as a date? Is that really something that you guys would do together?
Yeah, it is. I actually really, really want to watch it. So it's definitely a two-way thing, not just me going because he wants to watch it.
So it's not just Terrence saying, please.
No, definitely not.
I'm a very lucky man.
Terrence, do you think that there are some storylines that are still more towards guys? I mean, as you evaluate the different films that are coming out and you think to yourself, I'll ask Sim if she wants to go to that one. That's not really one. Are there some that are still more guy storylines?
Definitely. I think it maybe less so storylines, more so the characters. You know, there are particular characters and you know, superheroes or anti-heroes who definitely seem more boyish, male-dominant, but more and more, I think, the movies that are coming out, yeah, gender doesn't really matter anymore, if anything.
So they're making room for all sorts of markets.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, like, even if you look at the latest Batman Superman, you know, Wonder Woman played a very strong role in that film. Scarlet Witch in the Avengers. You know, just female leads are starting to get more and more prominent roles. So I don't think gender is much of an issue anymore in this scene.
Sim, you said that you're happy to go along with Terrence. I wonder if you think that your sort of acceptance extends to the rest of your peer group?
I think most of them are pretty comfortable going to these kind of movies and voluntarily and not being just being forced. But I do have friends who are probably bigger fans than their boyfriends themselves, actually.
Wow. Okay. Do you guys talk about the plot lines much? Do you think about what you're watching, or do you think it's just a bubblegum for the mind experience?
We do talk about it. Mainly it's before the movie, and Terrence might be giving me some context for what the plot's going to be about. But we don't exactly think about the plot that deeply. It's not like a, is there like a hidden meaning behind this about life sort of thing.
Yeah, I think for Sim and I, yeah, we try not to think about the films too deeply, especially with the superhero genre, if anything. You know, some other films maybe, but yeah, with superhero movies, I think we just try and go out and just have fun watching the movie. So yeah, not too seriously.
Well, we hope you guys have fun with X-Men Apocalypse. And, you know, obviously we could make this a regular segment, Sim. You're so excited about talking about this.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
Thanks very much, guys.
There are a couple of big revelations in that segment, Mark. I didn't realise the young ladies around the place were so into the superhero movies.
Actually, something it didn't include in that interview was the fact that there, a lot of them really, really like Captain America.
Oh, yeah? Really like.
Yeah.
But I was a little bit surprised at the end of here. Terrence and Sim say they don't think more deeply about the plot and what goes on screen in superhero movies after the movie. They talk a lot beforehand, but not afterwards, which is not what we're about here on this show. We love talking about what happened up on screen, how we think about it, how we bring that to, like, into our own life and mull it over and chew it over, et cetera, et cetera. And we don't want to rip the fun out of it.
No.
We just want to call everybody to have a good, hard think.
We just want to make a living.
No. But speaking of talking about big superhero movies, Mark.
Deadpool, Batman v Superman, Captain America, Civil War, 2016. Well, let's face it, hasn't been terribly short on superheroes on our big screens. X-Men Apocalypse is the latest super budget episode of the long-running franchise about multiple mutants from one of the Marvel Comics' most popular universes. Will Apocalypse only inspire fatigue through being part of the same thing that seems to be colouring up the screens? Or can it blast our senses with godlike superpowers and a zeal for building a better world? You decide.
Ever since the world found out about mutants, there have been secret societies who see them as some kind of second coming or sign of God. They believe that tens of thousands of years ago, an ancient being was born, the world's first
mutant. You are all my children, and you're lost because you follow blind leaders. But I am here now. I'm here for you.
Mark, that's the voice of Apocalypse speaking to us right then, played by Oscar Isaac. Oscar Isaac, yes, it's a bloke.
Oh, okay.
He's this ancient Egyptian dude that in an opening sequence has demonstrated that when he's kind of getting more of his power, like kind of getting an upgrade on his powers, things go bad. He gets trapped for a long time. And then we flash forward to the 80s where most of the action is set in X-Men Apocalypse. And similar to First Class, and then similar to the first X-Men movie, as in the one some time ago where we first got Hugh Jackman as Wolverine and where it kind of launched X-Men. What was that, back in the late 90s, probably? Early 2000s. Similar to that, it there's a kind of rebuilding, regrouping of the various sides of the mutants that are on show in the X-Men universe, and a bit more kind of origin stories going on for a few different characters, but we also get back with the same one. So Charles Xavier, played by James McAvoy, Eric/Magneto, played by Michael Fassbender, Raven, Mystique, Jennifer Lawrence, all of them are in here. And basically what happens is all these interlocking threads of storylines eventually come together to either be on the side for or against Apocalypse.
Right.
You have to say it like that, Mark.
And I know. Now, look, I know, maybe our listeners, viewers don't, that you're not the biggest disciple of superhero films from the
that
kickoff.
That is a true fact.
Okay. And X-Men, you did the good service. You went out to the premiere. And Michael Fassbender was there.
Yeah, Michael Fassbender thought he'd show. It was like me and Michael Fassbender and many other people.
Yeah, and besides hanging out with the Fass.
Being the Fass, we're there. He did a very good job of saying, enjoy the film. And then went off.
Like, always a tricky thing without an auto cue.
I know. How are you going to land it? He did it. He nailed it. So, well done, Fass. Well done.
You were surrounded by the FAS and the fans.
And the fans.
Okay. Did they love Apocalypse? Did you love Apocalypse?
I didn't love Apocalypse. The fans, I think the fans probably loved it a little bit more than I did. It wasn't the kind of preview where people, you know, where it's erupting, where you can get this energy in the room. That wasn't really happening. The film goes for 2.5 hours. So there is that sort of diminishing level of interest across the film, unless it can really hold your attention. I don't think X-Men Apocalypse really does that. Mainly because it does feel like the same. And my recollection of the entire X-Men universe isn't great. But as I was sitting there watching all these various mutants come together and even their motivations and you know what's driving them, what's caused them to be how they are, et cetera, all of that felt horribly familiar in a way that X-Men Apocalypse didn't overcome. So it didn't make me want to grab onto these people anymore, these mutants any stronger than when I walked in. But I think fans, if you've got investment in it, there's one of those scenes in this movie, of course, where Wolverine shows up. That's not a spoiler. You know he's going to show up. The crowd went off, but even when he did show up and what he did, most people walk out going, I've seen all that before.
It wasn't really his franchise anyway.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. It was just showing up like the Stan Lee cameo and all that kind of thing. It just felt like trotting out familiar things over and over. And even the storyline, injecting this new villain Apocalypse, sure, that's new. But the varying sides of the X-Men debate and how they're going to go head to head just seems recycled constantly.
Yeah, it does seem to be the constant theme. Okay, well, look, the word Apocalypse conjures up images of end of the world, destruction. So what kind of stuff do we get to see blown up? I mean, we're sitting down and we're going to see stuff blown up.
The Opera House. You get to see the Opera House blown up.
Again?
How dare they?
Australia, do you notice you just do the Opera House?
That's all they did. And large swathes of Cairo gets it. And the consequence of loss of human life in this isn't very great. If you walk away thinking, I know Terrence and Sim won't, but if you walk away thinking about what actually went on here, the value of human life is pretty low in the X-Men universe. But more things are blowing up in terms of emotional responses, personal relationships, everything from, you know, all the revenge and the fear and the retaliation and the prejudice that you get with the X-Men films, all of that is back on show, particularly in the form of Eric Magneto, something that happens involving his character and Charles Xavier and all these other ones. That actually, there's a real oomph at one point in this film that I found fantastic, like actually made me feel something for this. And then after that, pretty much died off, apart from being rocked constantly by how violent the X-Men movies are. These movies are a lot more violent than in their graphic depiction of violence, a lot more hard-hitting than most other superhero films. I think there are a number of sequences in this film that I think if you were considering taking your younger children to, and this film's rated MA 15+, so think about that seriously. There are some very strong scenes in this that you won't expect from, that you don't get in other Marvel, more kind of sanitized violence that you see in some of the other Marvel films.
Yeah, you've actually picked up on something really kind of interesting there, because I know we'll thank Terrence and Sim for coming on the show and sharing their thoughts. But there is an interesting distinction happening here, because we talk about thinking, and you also said that this is a film that's going to leave you feeling really strongly about some things. And so some people can come out feeling some things, and you're warning us against the sort of feelings that might be generated by this film. There do seem to be the usual themes of revenge, fear, retaliation, prejudice coming up. Is there anything new, any new issue that's being brought out?
I can't remember the concepts of superpowers, God, and Apocalypse in terms of destroying everything and starting again, language of cleansing, salvation coming through in X-Men films as strongly as it does in X-Men Apocalypse. There is so much talk, everything from a Jesus figure that appears right at the start of the movie to Tower of Babel reference, to creation reference, to people praying to God. One of the X-Men prays to God. And towards the end of the film, there's talk about the grace of God. All of this swirling around in this X-Men universe, which on the other hand, like you've commented recently about Captain America and Civil War and that side of the Marvel universe, on the other hand, it wants to kind of uphold this universe where there is no God, there is no control, there is no ultimate being. Pretty much it's just you working on your own abilities and trying to navigate your own course. And if you kind of believe in yourself and tap into what you know to be true or to be right, go for it. X-Men sort of shows that as well. But at the same time, it has this really new element, I thought, of a desperate search for higher meaning. And again, this is scene involving Magneto where he cries out to God in this way that left me, I'm still confused about what this film actually is trying to leave me with when it comes to how do I think about this universe and where God sits in it. It's like they were trying to inject God in but take God out at the same time. very confused, and like the film overall, left me a little bit cold in terms of it just being, well, you know, largely more of the same, just with a few minor modifications along the way.
Yeah, but I like the fact that that's actually tying into a universe. We're allowed to actually think it now about God in the cinemas.
They were allowing it, very much so. They really opened the door and then tried to shut it at the same time. But as you can hear me talking about it, there are so many different examples to list off. You can't actually shut the door on something you've opened. And I think it demonstrates a need in those who were making the film to express something about this universe that maybe even they don't understand.
Okay. Well, X-Men Apocalypse stars a battalion of people in jumpsuits or blue makeup, including Jennifer Lawrence, Michael Fassbender, and James McAvoy. It opened nationally on Thursday, May 19. It's rated MA15+ for science fiction themes and violence. That's a strong but fair rating for this superhero film. Parents, consider yourselves warned. Violence is in there fairly significantly this time round. Actually, in the next edition of Eternity, if you'd like to check that out, the June edition of Eternity, I'm actually writing a fairly extensive article on the rise of the Marveling universe. We actually have the Marvelian idea of what's going on and the themes that are traveling through. So, look, personally, I feel like we are living in a whole new age of it's okay to talk about God.
Still to come on the show, what the Bible has to say about wasting time, and then what I have to say are the top 5 time-wasting films. Yes, indeed. You are still with The Big Picture. Congratulations. There is no better place that you should be right at this point in human history.
It's true. All human history has been leading up to... Actually, to be honest, it's been leading up to the return of Christ.
Yeah,
but before then, you should listen to this episode.
Really, really, really glad you inserted that there because I was hoping to get to that. But speaking of time, have you got any time wasters in your life? You do? And actually, hang on a minute. Is the person that you're thinking of that delights in wasting time, is that person actually you? But Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark is back this week to tell us that the good book isn't that opposed to letting a little time go to waste.
Dithering tends to get a bad rap. It's condemned as time-wasting, getting distracted, lacking ambition, lacking focus. But isn't that just typical of our misguided, pedestrian, human approach to things? In this more fabulous world that God created, it turns out that dithering plays an important role. That's what I've learnt recently from a foray into the world of computer hardware. Apparently, many computers work better if there's a good deal of background vibration and white noise around them. Who would have thought? It's a bit like a newborn trying to sleep. They startle easily if things are too quiet. Better to turn on the vacuum cleaner, as many of us were told by the nurse. Now, this is profoundly counterintuitive. We're more likely to try to ensure that things are as settled, orderly, predictable as possible. Now, I'm not suggesting you start shaking your laptop up and down to improve its performance, but perhaps as a metaphor, this unexpected truth about dithering has a good deal to teach us. Perhaps attacking the problem head-on is not always the best way to come to a solution. Well, a friend told me about a water company that was trying to sell their products. The problem was their products were water and sewage. How do you spice up the sales pitch for that? Well, you dither about a bit and see what emerges. And it emerged that there hadn't been a platypus sighting in the Yarra River for over a decade. Why? Because no one cared about water quality. They were throwing their rubbish in the river, dumping chemical waste, and they thought nothing about it. But the public did care about the platypus. They wanted to see it back. And 19 years after the program commenced, there's now a blog where people can record their platypus spottings. When they go there, they learn about water conservation, and the goals of the organisation are achieved by the background noise of the platypus, where the direct marketing approach about water and sewage had failed. How do you get a baby to sleep? Vacuum around it noisily. How do you get people to care about water? Make loud public noise about the platypus. The way forward isn't always obvious and sometimes requires some dithering. Well, theologians might get a bit sweaty over this one, but perhaps dithering is a good metaphor for the way the Spirit of Christ sustains the world. In several parts of the New Testament, we're told that the Spirit not only created the world, but also upholds it in an ongoing way. The image and word of God dithers around our precious lives, disturbing us, just enough to get us back on the straight and narrow, ruffling our feathers so we readjust our plumage properly. I really like it that the word dithering emerges from the Middle English verb dideren, which means to tremble. Trembling before the Lord really does make your life more secure. The trembling feels uncomfortable, perhaps unsafe, but it is in fact the very thing that is keeping your life on track.
Look, just for the Gen Y listeners and for the rest of us, dither means to basically not do much. In fact, there'll be a T-shirt in that, I think. Have you been dithering?
Speaking of dithering, Mark, let us dither no more as we get to the top five time wasters list for this week. There are a number of ways we could have gone with this. You and I, being professional film reviewers, we have wasted many a time at many a wasteful movie.
I like to remind people of this, that for every, like, I might see a few films in a week, and for every 10 films I see, 7 I wish I hadn't.
They are not all gold, everybody. They are not all gold. Haven't you been listening to some of the reports we've been filing here on The Big Picture? So what I thought I would do is look across my life and think about the top 5 movies that most wasted my time, and there are significant reasons why they have made the list.
Wow.
5.
1998, Mark, I found myself on holiday in New York City. Great place to be on holiday. One of the things I wanted to do in New York City was, well, there are plenty of things you could you have on everyone's list, like Statue of Liberty and Empire State and all that sort of thing, Central Park. What I wanted to do was see a movie. I wanted to see a movie in New York City.
The American experience.
That seemed like the most Woody Allen thing I could do, like that scene in Annie Hall where people are lining up and Woody Allen's kind of whinging about movies and stuff. I wanted to be that guy. I wanted to be Woody Allen in New York City.
Did you wear a velvet jacket with elbow pads?
I wished that I had, but if I did, it would have been a massive waste on the movie that I went and eventually wasted my time on. I was with my then girlfriend at the time. She suggested we see, this is in 1998, and this is why it makes my top 5 list, Shakespeare in Love. The first movie.
How I feel about that film.
I've been to New York City a couple of times. I've seen movies since, but the first movie I ever saw in New York City, Shakespeare in Love, and my goodness,
the best picture
winner of that year, and wasn't even the best picture I saw that afternoon. Like, it still haunts me at how I wasted money in New York first time round I was there on Shakespeare in Love.
4.
Then we flash back a little bit earlier in my history. 1993, I was in year 12. I was going to the cinema, must have been a school holiday, going with my brother Ryan and our mate Darren. Ryan and Darren, I should have known this from the outset because I know them quite well. They don't know what they're talking about when they're talking about movies. They don't know. Okay. I had some idea, and my movie knowledge was escalating as I was getting older. I didn't want to rub it in their faces, but I knew what time it was with movies, even at that stage in year 12. I can't remember what the other choices were that we had, but in this particular holiday, when we go into the big bad city to go to a cinema to watch a movie in 1993, it's number 4 on my time wasters list, Reckless Kelly. Do you remember Reckless Kelly?
Well, actually, I had therapy about that.
Yeah, I think most people have ever since they've seen that. Starred Yahoo Serious. For anyone who doesn't know who Yahoo Serious was, he burst onto Australian fame and even international fame with Young Einstein. I think that was like 1988, which was a kooky but kind of funny, weird movie about Einstein being from Tasmania. That movie was quite cool. His follow-up, Reckless Kelly,
which was pretty much the same film,
but playing Ned Kelly as a kind of like larrikin. I can't even remember what happened. I was so bored and angry at my brother and his mate. The only thing I really remember about that film is the opening titles. There's a camera that's upside down that's going across water as that Great Southern Land song plays by Icehouse. That's the only lingering memory because I blocked out the entire rest of the film from my mental archives because it scarred me so much. But not nearly as much as...
3.
Okay, let's jump forward a little bit in time. 2001, I was by that stage on the verge of getting paid to be a film reviewer. So I hadn't quite reached that excellent place in your life where you don't have to pay for movies. And not trying to rub it in, but my goodness, when you get there, it is awesome when you don't have to pay for movies. How good is it? Come on.
I'm slightly different. I tell my friends, not only do I not pay for tickets these days, but I actually don't go see a film unless somebody's paying me.
Yeah, that's how we are, as modestly and humbly as we could possibly say it. Well, maybe a better way to put it is, even after having seen a lot of free films, and some of them are terrible, I can still appreciate how good it is to not pay for films.
It's a great pleasure.
Particularly when you remember when you did pay for a film and it was a shocker.
Oh yeah, you shelled out something like $20 just to see something.
Well, back in 2001, it was probably like $2. But it was my hard earned $2.
You'd done the paper run for that $2.
And what I should have realized as I was going into the cinema is this wasn't going to end well, because this was in a really tiny cinema. You know, this cinema complex has got about 8 cinemas, but there's always that one. It's like a cupboard. And you still have to pay full price, but you get shuffled into the cupboard. There's no one else in there. And I think it was even cheap ticket day, but no one's in there. Like, okay. This film was AI, Artificial Intelligence, that Steven Spielberg film. Terrible. That film was terrible. So much so that I slept several times in that film. It's so long. It goes for about 4 days, and it has about 15 different endings in it. I slept through, I reckon, say, two of them. I'd wake up and I'm still going, that boy's still a robot and he's got a teddy bear and he's in some future thing. I fell asleep again. There's something about Jude Law happening. I don't really know what's going on. Yawn. I went back to sleep and walked out feeling like I didn't even get my $2 worth out of sleep in AI, artificial intelligence. Tell me I'm wrong, Mark.
I own the collector's edition.
Oh, mate. So because you have trouble sleeping at night? Because you have more time to waste in your life?
I would have thought because, well, let's not, you know, we'll have the fisticuffs off screen.
We shall. Two. I picked this number two choice because it didn't do what it was meant to do. It was meant to be a time waster for kids. This was chosen at a, I think it was part of a, do you know the club Apex, like Rotary? I'm not sure. I think Apex still exists. My dad was in Apex. We used to go to these like conventions or kind of weekend conferences that you know adults go to. And when you're a kid, you're not really sure exactly what the adults are doing, but you get shuffled off into different rooms where people look after you at different times of day. In one of these rooms, they did the usual thing, which is a pretty smart choice. You put on a movie. And you would think that you would pick a movie that kids, at very least, you would suspect would respond well to.
So you think this is kind of like an adult's choice of what they think kids like?
I think it was an adult's choice of what they wanted to watch. And instead of wasting this time with kids, like, I'm just going to waste it by watching something I want to watch. And this is why at number two, The African Queen shows up from 1951, which, to be fair, is an excellent film.
It's a fantastic film.
But it took me, I reckon, 25 years. I think I saw this when I was 8. It took me 25, maybe longer, years to actually go back and watch this Humphrey Bogart, Katharine Hepburn masterpiece because I was so scarred as a child because the only thing I remember about The African Queen is it was like, you know, when you're a child and you have to sit somewhere and you just want to get up, go anywhere else, but you're so obedient and trying to do the right thing. You just sit there and instead you're watching this horribly boring piece of work that it had something about leeches in it. That was the only thing I could remember when I was 8 about The African Queen that was positive.
About the only thing that comes close to that is when people show you their holiday videos. And you're sort of sitting there going, I've got to sit here. I've got to be good about this. And then I usually fake some sort of allergic reaction.
But I've reserved number one for... One. 2010's The Bounty Hunter. Jennifer Aniston, Gerard Butler, one of the worst so-called romantic comedies I've ever seen. The reason this makes it to my list is over the years of being able to go to film previews, premieres, it's been great to get a double pass and you get to take a mate or someone else is significant in your life. My mate Pete used to come to some films with me. In my own defense, I told him, mate, like, this is probably not going to be very good. I explained to him the scenario. It's a Jennifer Aniston and Gerard Butler. They're thrown together. Something about their divorce, but it's in the same movie and he has to, he's a bounty. I can't remember what was happening in it. Pete said, sure, I'll come along. Within the, I think it was just the opening titles, he walked out, went to the toilet, and he came back, I reckon, 10 minutes later, and he just sat and, like, you know, groaning, and we slumped down in our seat further and further and further till you're almost on the floor because you just don't want to watch what's going on screen. Later, he admitted to me that when he went to the toilet, he seriously considered not coming back. He was just going to ditch me. And that was at the titles. That was at the titles. So, in honor of my mate Pete and him coming back and wasting time with me in 2010 on The Bounty Hunter, I choose The Bounty Hunter as the number one time-wasting film.
Are you sure you can handle this?
I won't even break a sweat.
There's a black SUV that's been following us.
They may want to kill me.
The only person right here who wants to kill you is me.
What the hell have you got yourself into?
Oh, now you're interested.
Half of New Jersey is looking for you.
Where the hell is Milo?
Milo.
Milo, the other half is looking for your ex-wife.
We gotta go undercover.
What a pleasure, Senator.
I'm actually a former model.
Really? How long ago was that?
Actually, I think that's something that unites us with people who appreciate films. That on the other end, we also have the story of the 2 hours we will never get back.
Yep, and that was the list of the many hours I'm never going to get back. That was this week's show, Mark. Well, coming up next week, a show that you're definitely going to want to waste your time on.
We give you a fabulous kiddie-centric cinema and TV show extravaganza.
Have you heard of the regular show? Your kids have.
Bet they haven't heard of The Hunt for the Wilder People.
No, but both are on our show next week, along with another crazy Tim Burton adventure into Wonderland, Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Plus my top five child actors. They're actually not there, and they're not just the cute ones.
And still that week, I will be Ben McCacken.
And I'm Mark Hadley. See you next week.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.